You are about to enter the pop, pulp, and subcultural minds of several individuals. What may leak into the ether can sometimes be too strange, too confusing for the average human mind. When nerds assemble. Hello, and welcome to episode 57 of the Nerds Assemble podcast. I'm Emily.
I'm Paul.
I'm Paul, aka Retroid.
And today we have no Kiki, but that's right, because we are joined by Pete Rogers, who's here to talk about the news and his Kickstarter project, Forgotten Planet, a jam-packed SF graphic novel.
Hello.
We'll be discussing several bits of news and obviously the graphic. The first thing we need to get out of our systems, just because it was horrific when I saw it on Facebook over the weekend, was that rumour that Justin Bieber was going to be Robin in the upcoming Batman Superman film. And I was just like, there's no way that's true, and whoever's tried to make a joke out of this is just evil. especially, of course, because they were doing it outside the context of April Fools, which makes it, you know, even more evil to suggest such a thing.
Maybe they were just trying to prove the point that it could be worse. You know, you might have problems with who's been cast as Batman, but come on, it could seriously be worse.
Yeah,
I believe the site responsible for this horrific fake script photograph with Bieber was Funny or Die.
Suddenly makes sense.
Yeah, it was not.
In this case, die.
Yeah, it was not.
Robins tend to die, so you know.
Yeah, what was a bit ridiculous though is that I knew it couldn't be true from the cynic's perspective of nobody would want to work with Bieber, like after all the crap he's got up to in the past 12 months.
No, 90-year-old girl cast as Batman.
No filmmaker in their right mind would want to work with Justin Bieber at the moment. He's not, you know, it's like, don't work with children, animals, or Justin Bieber. That's kind of where I'd be kind of leaning towards.
Technically, Justin Bieber kind of encompasses the other two.
I thought the entire thing was just unbelievable.
I'm
so sorry.
Evil beyond,
but still not as bad as Justin Bieber still existing.
Things that are bad or not, though. I'm gonna move us on to our first proper bit of news.
Oh, I've got some venom for this. I haven't played the game. But there you go.
J.J. Abrams has said that he has been emotionally hurt by the official Star Trek game that came out this year before the movie release. That kind of was a sort of precursor to the movie. Paul beside me and myself, we did try playing the co-op version of the game on Xbox 360.
Seeing as it was touted heavily on that.
We did not complete said game. For those who were unaware, it was it Digital Extremes? Was it Digital Extremes?
Wasn't it meant to be this?
The ones that made the Darkness.
Yeah, that's what I was
Second
thinking.
Darkness
The Second
game.
Darkness game.
Yeah. They were responsible for the Star Trek game. I have a nice long quote I could read out from Abrams' interview, but it's pretty.
You can't summarize it.
How do I summarize it? So he,
it was bad.
It was bad. Where the emotionally hurt bit comes in. For me, emotionally, it hurt because we were working our asses off making the movie, and then this game came out, and it got, this isn't even my opinion, it got universally panned. I think that it was something without question that didn't help the movie and arguably hurt it.
I'll tell you what hurt the movie.
What?
It being shit.
It was a bit too predictable, that movie. The game was also quite predictable. I think they've been a bit unfair on the studios involved because they didn't have very long to actually make the game.
No, I think it's, frankly, this is a little bit rich coming from him. It's like, oh, it hurt the movie. It's not really. People tend to treat games separate from movies anyway.
Yeah.
So with this, it's just, yeah. As I know people who did enjoy it, but it was still, it was just that it was a Star Trek game.
Maybe he just can't make Star Trek games that work.
Maybe he can't make Star Trek films.
It's a bit weird, I think, that he went on record and actually said this.
It is a bit. It was originally because it was I've got Eurogamer transcription of it, but basically the interview was with Gamer Hub. It's a long bit of emotional kind of breakdown. I'm surprised he wasn't crying by the end of it. But it was just kind of. It was a really bad game. At the same time, though, as retros can point out, it's a bit rich because the second film wasn't as good as the first one he did. And the reliance on certain plot points from the original films and the series were not helpful at all in creating something that wasn't predictable. It was a whole very predictable experience, that film.
It was incredibly predictable, and yet it tried to not be predictable by being a bit different, but it wasn't even a successful spin on Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
It was just, I mean, I was saying, you know, I've said before, the film didn't really remind me of Wrath of Khan. It reminded me of Star Trek Nemesis and Star Trek Insurrection, and those are not good things to be reminded of. So, yeah, the whole thing of, oh, yeah, it hurt the film. No. Not really. It was a separate thing. And also, you know, why have a go at them? I don't quite get that. It's just
I hate to think what one of the guys that works for the studio, cause I occasionally follow him on Twitter, and he's tweeted at me before, and he worked on Darkness 2, and then was like being all kind of like hit up. Well, not hit up. He was like being really positive about the game before its release, like in the months going up, like, oh, you know, been in like till like 2 or 3 in the morning, just gone past the security guards, you know, but it's all going well. So I have no idea.
Well, the thing is, no one wants to make a bad product, do they? You know, no. People just want to do the best they possibly can. And unless it's possibly ITV2, in which case I have no idea what the hell they're doing, and I don't think they do either. But it's just, yeah, it's like, Let's make this good. Let's make this enjoyable. Let's do our best. Let's do the, you know, if the, you know, he's doing the artwork. I'm not sure, you know, what he was doing, but you know, let's just do our very best on this, and hopefully it won't suck.
I'm gonna move this on because I think I want to go and talk about something positive because I hate positive. I think the coolest bit of news to come out in the past week was when things went a bit crazy because another Harry Potter film was announced. Well, we say Harry Potter, it's really not about Harry Potter, it's just set in that world. Rowling's going to write a script for a film based on Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them.
It's like, hey, what's that then? Because I haven't even seen, no, I've seen one of the Potter films.
I'm deeply disappointed that you don't. It's one of the main textbooks in like the novels and the films. It's written by the fictional character Newt Scamander. I don't know how you pronounce it. And it's basically, you know, it's like a sort of almost encyclopedic kind of book about various magical creatures, where to find them. But it's like it goes a bit more than where to find them because it has actually got a couple of survival methods in there sort of thrown in as well.
See, what would be good is if it was actually David Attenborough suggesting this.
A sort of a magical Hitchhiker's Guide.
Well, maybe not quite magic. I think it's probably going to be more following the character as he kind of compiles everything to write the book. And it probably involves a hefty dose of kind of sort of first-person research where he actually goes into the deepest, darkest depths of various corners of the world and finds these creatures that are quite intent on killing people. But I do wonder what kind of twists they could put on it because throughout the books and the films, there's always this kind of contention between the wizards and the witches that obviously lead the magical community versus actual magical creatures who are above a certain intelligence level. And I do wonder if that kind of sort of slight racism issue is going to rise again in the film. Because it kind of happened in the fifth Harry Potter film and I think the last two, well, certainly the first part of the last film, if that makes sense, because they split the book into, yeah.
Well, they did get a big toward the end, didn't they?
Yeah. So there's a lot of things they could draw upon, and obviously there's also the chance that they would encounter characters, older characters from the universe. So Dumbledore could easily show up, Hagrid could easily show up, even like a younger Professor McGonagall, you know, characters like that. It's all possible because of when the book, even in the Harry Potter world, you're looking at it's something that was written within the past 100 years. And right. Wizards and witches in the Harry Potter universe have this habit of existing perhaps a bit beyond the average human sort of lifetime.
A bit beyond the average muggle.
Yeah.
I'll take your word for that.
Yeah.
I know I really should, but I just, all the fuss about Harry Potter just sort of, you know, put me off.
Maybe you were just, I don't want to say this again, I've said it so, maybe you were just a little too old to appreciate it, maybe.
How dare you?
Considering I was in the Target market when the first book was released.
How old were you? Just making me depressed.
I was about 10 or 11 when the first book was released.
Ouch.
So I grew up reading Harry Potter books. I started reading them around book 2 or 3, before the film started coming out. And that wait between Prisoner of Azkaban and The Goblet of Fire was truly excruciating. But then again, it was nowhere near as excruciating as people waiting for A Dance with Dragons. So, you know.
For a second there, when you said A Dance with Dragons, I thought, I don't remember anything about Dance with Dragons in Harry Potter.
Well, the broom flying in the fourth. Yeah, yeah, you but, know, the broom fly.
But there's no dragon in there, is there?
There was in the fourth film, The Goblet of Fire, when there's the challenge.
Yeah.
And he's got to use his broom to help him get an egg from a dragon.
All right. Oh,
there's a broom and a dragon there. You just almost call it a dance.
This sounds like a text adventure solution. Use broom with egg. The egg smashes.
Yes, they see that's when you fail, unfortunately.
Which film was it that Harry can speak Slytherin or something?
Parseltongue. It starts off. It starts in the first film. It doesn't become a big issue until the second film.
I think it must be the second film that I watched then.
Okay. Probably
didn't help.
Yeah, probably. You kind of need to watch them all. I mean, the box set's kind of cheap now, or they keep repeating it on TV enough. You usually get them when it's like, oh, we're going to repeat all the films again, first weekend, go for it. You know, because it's just subsequent weekends.
Have a movie marathon, a bit like what we did this Saturday, watching three Iron Man films.
We didn't quite have enough time to fit Avengers in between Iron Man 2 and 3. If we had done it, would have taken us past 1 o'clock in the morning.
That was our only regret.
Yeah, but it's okay.
I still want an edit of the Avengers where it's just the Iron Man bit. I'm not a fan. I know I'm almost alone in that as well, but there you go. Yeah, so in closing, I should really watch Harry Potter or read Harry Potter or listen to the audiobooks of Harry Potter, and then I can watch this film.
Yes. Oh, you know what?
That's the thing. Is this just going to be a film in itself? Is this going to be a sort of a semi standalone original Rowling?
I think it's going to be a film in of itself. I mean, they're going to be drawn because Rowling's writing the script, so it's her first sort of screenplay. Like that's going to be produced.
They must be paying a rough fortune.
Apparently, though, it's also going to draw upon that. What's that annoying publishing hoo-ha deal that they've got with the Harry Potter stuff and Sony? It's an online thing.
Pottermore.
Yes, Pottermore. They're going to be potentially drawing upon stuff from Pottermore. There we go. Thank you, Pete.
Oh, is that online portal thing with bits of writing on it?
I just don't go near that. I'm quite happy with like the books and the films. I do actually have a book of Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them because they released that and Quidditch Through the Ages for sort of stuff to help raise money for Comic Relief a few years back. So,
Worthy
yeah, so I've got book versions and they're quite cool. I mean, they're tiny because, you know, they could have tried writing some of those kind of Harry Potter-like in length, and actually would have been more textbook-like in length, but that would have been a bit of a hard sell as a cheap charity raising.
Here's an idea, and this is one of those, you know, just make Paul rich schemes, publishers.
Uh-huh.
If you're going to do a new Harry Potter book or, you know, something like that, it's common. LCD screens are cheap now. So why don't you have an animated cover as a limited edition?
Oh, like they actually do for the fake books, well, for the books in the films.
Yes.
Yes, that would be quite cool, yeah.
Because I remember a few years back there was an advert in, was it Russian Vogue or something like that, where it was an LCD screen that they, you know, put in one of the issues. And they said, yeah, it only costed like, you know, a few quid to put a rolling advert on a little LCD screen in a magazine. So it's like, come on, it seems like a logical crossover with Harry Potter.
Yeah. I've seen people send flyers out now that have got video screens. So, yeah, it can't be that expensive anymore.
Yeah, it's like, come on.
The cost of the technology has come down enough to make it viable, yeah. That
people would love that.
Yeah, I think I probably would be suckered in enough to buy that. Totally.
I apologise in advance, and I demand a royalty check.
Okay, I'll go move this on to a slightly more negative piece of news, as a slice of gaming history ended last week with the closure of Blitz Game Studios.
This is a very sad thing.
I would like the perhaps more retro-minded individuals of this podcast to take over from here, because unfortunately I have no memories of Blitz.
Now, this is going to be a difficult one, because when it comes to... I know who was running it, and no, it was the Oliver twins who originally set up Codemasters in the 8-bit days, and they started off doing... a lot of simulator games like BMX Simulator and, you know, things like that. They sold really well in the budget days of the 8-bit computers in the UK. And then they struck gold on the Dizzy games. And they sold like hotcakes in a particularly cold winter. And there was a whole series of those that came out on, pretty much all home computers. They came out on Master System, I think possibly NES, Mega Drive. Dizzy was a big deal in its day, and it helped set Codemasters up. But the Oliver twins then spun off and formed Blitz Games. Now, there, I think that's part of the problem. I remember Blitz doing a few games, but no games that actually come to mind. So I apologize to the Blitz people who... I kind of know from Eurogamer. The Blitz Studios Twitter account actually follow me on Twitter, so. And I've got a few people on my Xbox Live friends list from Blitz as well, but I think they did a lot of supplementary work on UK industry games. And that's where a lot of the, you know, the good memories of people seem to be, because they said, you know, they gave me a step up, and they helped with this and they helped with that, and, you know, they were doing supplementary code work and art assets, you know, for this, that and the other. But when it came to the studio, they didn't seem to have, you know, particular breakout games, and that's been the problem.
I wonder how much the Dizzy Kickstarter hurt their plans.
I do wonder, because I don't wish them ill at all for that. I mean, like I said, Dizzy was hugely popular, but then if you're a retro collector, you kind of got sick to the back teeth of getting copies of Dizzy with every single bloody machine or collection you picked up. So I could probably build an igloo from copies of Dizzy on the Amstrad CPC and the Spectrum.
Would it be a warm igloo?
It would be a particularly cold, hard plastic.
See, I think because Dizzy has had its day and whatnot, but by the same token, I've never seen a Dizzy on Virtual Console or, you know, any of the other kind of, you know, retro Xbox Live Marketplace or...
There were avenues that they could have followed, but I don't know why.
I mean, it would have been a nice touch if they would have actually had it so that they released the games all in one, and you could actually change the graphics between the different systems that it was available on.
Yeah.
I reckon that would be quite cool.
I think there was an iOS Dizzy game.
Yes, there was.
And that was quite well received, and people liked it. So
but I think
maybe it just didn't do quite well enough. Or they banked too much on, the app stores.
Because the one thing that I saw that they had released, and I had heard of recently, was Kumo Lumo.
See, that's probably why I was having difficulty trying to think of things, because I haven't really been following, you know, the mobile app store games that much.
I do get the feeling that perhaps they, as a sort of more traditionally grounded student, perhaps jumped on handheld, well, as a handheld mobile, a little too much, and perhaps at just the wrong moment, because that hasn't, due to the fragmentation...
Yeah.
Obviously, of that as a market. Obviously, for
What we experienced at XPlay a lot, like a couple of years ago, there was a lot of talk about, you know, kind of going over to mobiles and, you know, kind of developing games for there. And it's like, that's all very well and good if you're a small indie developer that don't actually expect to get much money from it, because, you know, you will get a lot of people downloading it because it's cheap. But by the same token, you know, you won't necessarily generate the money that, you know, the big guys would get.
Yeah.
Another thing that I heard from Blitz was saying in statements was that they had a lot of projects there where they were obviously doing work for other studios and developers that had fallen through. So money that they had, you know, they were hoping to bank on didn't happen.
And in situations like that, it's often, you know, if you do the work and it goes through, then you get paid.
Yeah. There's no guarantee of getting paid until the work's finished, I suppose. You got the payment.
I'm looking at a list of, their recent games.
Mm.
And it's a lot of licensed sort of supplementary things. You know, things that you'd see, again, on the App Store.
Mm.
But, yeah, things like, let's see, Shrek Alarm, Wake Up with Disney, worked on Epic Mickey 2, The Power of Two, Puss in Boots game, Michael Phelps, Push the Limits, U-Star on MTV, SpongeBob Surf and Skate Road Trip.
Do you know what? I hate to use the term, but it's sounding like a lot of mobile shovelware.
It is, and it's the vicious circle that they'll have needed cash to develop games that they wanted to make. But in order to get that cash, they'll have had to have done a lot of these. And if a lot of these weren't doing that well, then they wouldn't have been able to do the games they wanted anyway, and, you know, just stuck doing things like this and just not going well. And it's a real pity, because they've got a lot of history to them, a lot of the people who worked with them.
I think what was, even though this has all been said, one nice thing that I saw happening on Twitter as a result of this was the amount of people that were trying to help Blitzers.
That is one of the fantastic things that happens when the studio closes down. You get a lot of people who are saying, you know, these are good people. You know, there must be people who need, they've got these positions, these vacancies. So, you know, here's someone who, you know, we can vouch for. You know, they're good. Get them.
Yeah. Because, I mean, was it somebody, I don't know who, but somebody set up a blitzjobs.tumblr.com. That was just basically posting links to loads of industry jobs going in the UK at the moment.
Yeah.
So that was nice. But yeah, it's just, I suppose it's a bit sad, really, seeing them kind of go. I'm going to move us on to our last bit of news for the week. Well, I say last bit of news, it depends. I might shoehorn something in a minute after this.
We're not being extremely chatty here.
I know. it's a bit sad. I'm going to give us some good news, and then I might bring up some awful news that isn't on here.
It's just like an emotional roller coaster.
I know.
Today, isn't it?
Ellen Page has said that she wouldn't mind doing a Kitty Pryde movie.
Could work.
Yeah.
To explain Kitty Pryde, what do they keep calling her in the X-Men? What's her X-Men name? Shadowcat in the X-Men universe. She has had her own standalone comics in the past. I'm not sure what her main sort of role is in the current series.
She's the principal of the school now.
Is she? Oh, God.
What?
I'm just staying completely silent because I have no idea what the hell's going on here. Yeah. Amongst yourselves.
Okay. So. She was being interviewed by Vulture, and sort of near the end of the interview, they brought up sort of like all the X-Men stuff.
That's Ellen Page, not Kit Paul, by the way.
Yeah. And
didn't just make up an interview with a fictional character.
And Paige says she's available to reprise the role. The character is actually appearing in Days of Future Past, which comes out next year.
Yeah, I think it is meant to be next year.
Yeah.
So, but I'm just trying to think how you would do it. I mean, I suppose it depends, really, because they want to keep it within the universe, how Days of Future Past kind of goes. But mind you, if she's saying, oh, she wouldn't mind reprising the role, maybe she knows that the ending of Days of Future Past is such that you could still do more films.
Well, I'm sure they won't close off the entire universe. And even then, give it 5 years and they'll do a reboot.
Yeah, but then you wouldn't have it on page if it was a reboot like that.
No, you could have Ellen Page, but with an evil beard.
Apparently, Joss Whedon said he wouldn't mind doing a spin-off movie of the character. And he said this a while back, but obviously this is kind of difficult for the fact that he's working with the actual Marvel Studios at the moment on all the Avengers stuff and all the X-Men film rights. So with Fox at the moment, and even the usual complicated mess for rights and what talent gets to work where. He would actually, though, be one of the most qualified people to write a film around her, because he's actually worked on comics involving her before as a character. Mm. So that's Ellen Page. Not Ellen Page, sorry. That's Kitty Pryde. Yeah, he hasn't been writing Ellen Page comics. He's been writing Kitty Pryde involved comics. This is all going horribly wrong.
That's when she decides to take a role on the upcoming Inception.
Oh, man.
Is Days of Future Past, is this a sort of, for want of a better term, is it sort of current X-Men or is it past X-Men?
Both.
It's both.
Yes.
Yeah, well, as you can see from a couple of the posters, they have both Patrick Stewart and, was it James McAvoy? And on the other poster, they have Michael Fassbender and Ian McKellen. So
okay.
they're having kind of them both there.
And also, if you were a fool when you went to see the Wolverine movie and didn't stay long enough to see the actual entire end of the film.
I hate when they do that, but...
At the same time, we it's been established now with Marvel films.
I like when they do it, but the number of times I've sat through the titles or the credits to, films and games, and there's been nothing.
Hmm.
Well, I can... because I had my review for Blacklist go up on the site today. I can tell you there is an extra bit for the ending of Blacklist if you do certain things, and I got that. So
right.
do stay to, like, a certain point of the credits for that, yeah.
Do they unlock Michael Ironside's proper voice?
No, sadly not. It also doesn't fix the online, which a commenter on the site pointed out was... very possibly due to technical issues on Ubisoft's end with the servers, which is why there doesn't appear to be anyone online for Splinter Cell Blacklist on the Wii U. Because every time I've tried to play online, there's been nobody there.
Which is...
There's an alternate explanation, which I'm not going to...
Well, yeah, there's that. But then this one guy was like, oh, I do actually play online, blah. And I was like, okay. But then it's like, but the servers haven't been working properly. It's like,
It just means that, because obviously they've encoded it so that there's, a lot of different portions in the game where it's designed so that you need a second person to go and explore and, go around a different route and whatnot. And it basically just blocks that because you don't have, on same console or offline co-op and story mode, and you can't access the online co-op. Well, you can't find a partner for the online game.
My review on Hex is rather incomplete due to the fact that it's a mess for the online capabilities at the moment. But get moving back to Ellen Page and Kitty Pryde, I'm now wondering, though, whether or not Kitty Pryde is in of herself a recognised enough character in order to have
her. She's a big part of the original Days of Future Past comic book storyline. She's pretty much the central character, so I guess maybe she's saying that because she's more kind of front and centre in this film, that I guess if it does well, then it's probably a springboard there.
Mm. Yeah.
Because I honestly couldn't have said who she was. And I liked... Was she in First Class?
No,
she's in the third...
Yeah.
Oh, the third X-Men. All right. Yeah. No, not such a wonderful
one. You've wiped it from your memory.
Yeah, but... it's just...
It was interesting because we were watching something at the cinema the other day, and an advert for a PS3 game came up. Quantic Dream one, which actually had Ellen Page on.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, so that's why there was a bit of a weird kind of, you know, legal kerfuffle between them and the guys that made The Last of Us.
Is that Naughty Dog?
Yeah.
I believe it could be.
Yeah. So, yeah. Oh, dear Ellen. She just wants to be in everything now. I think. Or what if she turns into the actress equivalent of like J.J. Abrams? I'm not sure.
On-screen equivalent of Nolan North.
That'd be brilliant, though, because, I mean, if you think about it, you know, once she's actually finished with the lines and doing a take and whatnot, she can basically not bother using the door and just basically walk to the next set through the walls. That'd be kind of cool.
Yeah. Okay. I'm gonna slot in the. Okay. We're gonna end with a piece of negative news, but that's okay because Pete's thing is entirely positive.
Okay.
So we'll end on a high. In case, so you know how we talked last week about the whole Batwoman thing, and then the whole Harley Quinn thing. Well, there's been a response to the Harley Quinn thing. To the art talent competition thing.
You're not gonna like it.
It was basically between the sort of like responses from on Twitter and I think on their site, Dan Dio, and a couple of people were like, "Oh, it's okay if you put it in the context of it meant to be sort of like a Looney Tunes type thing. It's all okay." And basically, the competition remains as is. And they cut all the responses. I'm summarizing from memory here, having read through a whole load of stuff yesterday. Their response essentially missed the kind of like point. It wasn't the fact that people were objecting to the sexualization of the character because Harley Quinn's already quite sexy because of the character design. It's the fact that obviously in that final panel she's naked and trying to kill herself, and it was just kind of like, it's the fact that we've got, you know, we got sex and suicide just kind of rolling into one there.
Sexy side?
Yeah, sexy side, and so they kind of missed the point there with people objecting, and there was just a couple of other angles that were just like, oh, we don't get why you're annoyed with us at all. We it's a perfect, you know, it's all in the best possible taste because it's all in the best possible taste, in the sense that, oh, it's meant to be a whole jokey thing. She's not really trying to kill herself. It's all part of a scene where she's, you know, just trying, you know, doing it, kind of breaking the fourth wall and blah. And it's like, well,
because it's a Harley Quinn. What's she like?
Oh. Yeah. You know, it's just like, yeah.
There's a reason why your market's shrinking.
Meanwhile, my purchase of Marvel comics increases every month, and other publishers as well, such as, I'm buying IDW stuff at the moment, bit of Boom Studios here. I'm very tempted to pick up this week's prog, because there's a new comic storyline launching. It's called Winds of O. It's the one I linked you to. Ordinary. It's called Ordinary.
Yeah.
And it's about a guy who wakes up one day and everyone else has got superpowers and he doesn't. The funny thing about this, and the reason this caught my attention, was the fact that Paul beside me had an idea for a comic, well, not a comic, but a film or TV series like this many moons ago. And somebody else has gone and done it. So I'm interested in picking up this week's like prog.
Literally years ago, I had the idea.
There was Max Normal in 2000 AD years ago. Although that wasn't superpowers, it was just the fact he was a very normal sort of 20th century bloke in Mega City.
Brilliant. But yeah, so essentially my current purchasing plans for comics don't involve any DC, despite the fact that I would like to victimize myself a bit more with Justice League Dark and seeing what the new Constantine is like. I'm not going near any DC comics at the moment, and in fact, as I previously stated, it's now seeming more than likely that Tony Stark has become my favourite fictional billionaire, overtaking Bruce Wayne. I never thought I'd see the day, but I think it's happened.
So he just needs a bit of a family murder.
Somebody needs to get fridged. That's clearly what needs to happen.
Clearly.
And it'll be fine. The fridge Jarvis, don't worry, in the upcoming Iron Man comics that are coming out of like Kieran Gillen's head. They'll be like, yeah, let's fridge Jarvis. Let's see what happens then.
You see now, if I didn't realise that Jarvis was an actual person in the comic books, I'd just be like, what's the point of sticking a computer in the fridge? Because that would get run faster.
Well, he is a computer in the current comics.
Okay.
Yeah, he's not a person in the current comics. He is a person, obviously, in the more the original run of comics.
Have you seen that in the US they've launched a Siri version that's Jarvis for iOS? But they haven't launched it in the UK, unfortunately.
Oh.
I saw there was like a app. Yeah. What annoys me though is the fact that it's for iOS and I use Android because I don't believe in iPhones.
That kind of reminds me the personal assistant and voice activation and things like that. Apparently Microsoft are working on one. This isn't a joke.
Is it going to be as reliable as Bing?
Yeah, they're calling it Cortana. There's going to be lots of 7-foot-tall, love-struck future soldiers going, oh, my girlfriend left me. By the way, where's the closest shop that closes at 8?
I'm sorry, I'm just imagining that somebody from like the Xbox's marketing team has ended up somewhere in like the mobile division and kind of gone, you know what sells stuff? Do you know what really sells stuff? You just put Halo something and it sells.
Having a virtually naked, virtual blue gloving girlfriend in your hand. And that sounds so bad.
It sounds really bad.
Yes, it does.
It sounds incredibly bad.
I'm surprised that nobody's actually cotton on to the idea of doing it so that's a customizable voice.
Well, in Siri, you could...
I want Brian Blessed, there you go.
Yeah. I thought Siri, you could have it as a male voice or a female voice. So you've at least got that.
No, I thought it was male in the UK and female in the US. I thought, anyway. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't own an iPhone, so why would I?
I try to keep away from iPhones.
The guy who does the UK Siri voice is also the voice that tells you that you're the weakest link.
that's not terribly endearing.
You are the weakest link. Goodbye.
That's not terribly endearing at all. Speaking of iPhones, did you guys hear about the 24-month EE contract that I saw touted on Twitter last week for the iPhone 5S?
What the hell would be the point of that? Because the point of iPhones is that they're replaced yearly. So why would you have a 2-year contract with an iPhone?
Okay, so I'm going to move us on to the final part of our show for this week because I really want to talk about it because it looks quite groovy and there's aliens, damn it. We're going to talk about Forgotten Planet, a graphic novel that Pete has written. It's currently got a Kickstarter going.
has indeed.
Which we will be linking to on the write-up for this episode. But I think what people really need to know first up is, they want to know, obviously, what the heck is Forgotten Planet about?
Sure. Well, it's a sci-fi action-adventure, is probably the best way to describe it. It's all centres around, in 2006, when Pluto lost its planet status. In our story, basically, when that comes out into the news, it reminds mercenaries that fought in a secret war on Pluto in the 70s what happened. So those who remember, whose memories come back, are basically assassinated. There's one guy called Kel Beckett, who's living in Tanzania on a game reserve, but he actually remembers everything, but he's deliberately cut himself away from society. But when they come and try and kill him, they can't, and he has to basically return to Pluto to find out what's happened.
Okay. It's quite a, looking at quite a chunk of it, you've gone for about, was it 100 pages?
Or something? Yeah, it'd be 100 pages, and the equivalent of kind of four sort of digital issues.
Brilliant. Other than yourself, who else is sort of working on it?
The artist that's working with me is an Italian guy called Giancarlo Caracuso. Hopefully I said that correctly. He's worked on Iron Man before, Formic Wars, Jonah Hex, Gorilla Man. So he's got he's worked on the big two quite a bit. He's worked on Random Acts of Violence for Image and Last Resort for IDW as well. So he's worked with some much bigger names than me and much bigger publishers. So it's really pleased to have him on board.
Awesome. Is it going to be full colour?
Yes, full colour. Yeah, it'll be full colour. We've also the original artist is a guy called Azim Akbarali that I've worked with quite a few times before. He's got kind of an Alex Ross kind of painted style. He lives in Tanzania, which is one of the reasons that Tanzania features in the story. That was sort of the inspiration for that. But unfortunately, he couldn't continue with the book, so we're going to use some of his art for the dust cover. Mm. And we've also got Mike Collins and Chris Wildgoose are both doing pinups for the book as well. So got a good little art team together.
Awesome. Avengers, how's the Kickstarter been going for you guys so far? Because you're on your last 2 weeks now. Sort of
It's a typical Kickstarter fashion. It kind of went really, really first day, it really flew. And there's a website that I would advise no one to ever go on if they're doing Kickstarter called KickTrack, which shows you the trend. Because I watched it go from you're going to do 200% to you're going to do 50% in the space of about 3 days. Because it obviously just bases on aggregating what you're doing each day. So what tends to happen with the Kickstarter, you get a big influx at the start when people first hear about it, and you know, family and friends and you know, wider kind of social media people get on board. Then you tend to get a lull in the middle and then a bit of a run at the end. The psychology is weird as well, because I think people won't back something unless they think it's going to get there. But if they don't back it, it's not going to get there. I've heard a few people say, oh, just like, you're going to make it, so I'm not going to pledge. Like, well, it doesn't cost you anything until the end, and only if we succeed. And if everyone thinks that way, we're not going to get there anyway. So we're on about 26%, which is about $3,000. And we need to get to 11.5. So we've got a long way to go, but I'm just hopeful that enough people will be interested. And the thing is with this, if we don't succeed through this method of funding, then we've got other avenues open to us to look at to try and get the book out there, because it would be, I wouldn't like the thought of us, you know, this book never coming out. So mm-hmm. It'd be good to find another way.
Is it your own label publishing it, or is it somebody else's?
It's Scar Comics, which is Shane Chebsey, who used to run the Birmingham comic show that used to be on, and he's put out some other kind of award-winning books like Madame Samurai and stuff before. He's also in a singer in a band where Charlie Adlard is the drummer, which is pretty cool. He's got a really good track record of putting out other books before. So we were kind of chatting about this concept, and then thought we'd take it further. And then because of getting this kind of level of artist on, so we've looked at Kickstarter as a way to pull the whole thing together.
Okay.
Can I just ask, so obviously Forgotten Planet is quite close to the name Forbidden Planet. Is there kind of any kind of harking back to kind of old-y kind of sci-fi?
There's definitely a pulp element there. I mean, the first film I ever saw in the cinema was Flash Gordon, and the very camp kind of 80s one, but that film was kind of, you know, having been the first cinema experience, it's kind of stayed with me. So one of the reasons that... the original War is in the 70s. I just like the idea of playing with the time, you know, jumping from kind of 2006 to 1976, which is what happens in the story. So you get to see quite a lot of the original stuff that was happening in the 70s. I just think the 70s is quite a cool period as well. And 70s sci-fi was quite interesting. So we kind of wanted to do that.
Obviously, as Pluto was known in real life, it's quite a inhospitable location, one might say, perhaps even impossible to actually really do anything on because it'd be so cold.
Mm-hmm.
What's the sort of science that you've kind of brought in for like enabling people? No spoilers. Is there science?
A lot of it takes place underground.
Okay.
So below the ice surface. Yeah.
Okay, that would help.
Yeah, but it's interesting because will this spoil it? I don't think so. But there's my favourite scene, or one of my favourite scenes is how can I? I'm just trying to think if this will spoil it or not.
if you don't want to, don't spoil.
I'm just trying to think now. Okay, well, but what I basically have done is I took the real life timeline of space exploration from the sort of early 70s onwards, including the bits of, and actually earlier than that, when Pluto was discovered, right the way through to 2006. That was my starting point. Mm. And then I kind of had my fictional ideas and I tried to meld the two together. So I've taken real things and used them as inspiration and sort of paired them off with each other. So actually the temperature drop thing does come into the story. And a day in the 70s when part of Alaska was actually on that day the coldest place on Earth, and not either of the poles is actually part of the story. But that's probably as much as I can say.
Okay,
it's almost linked to the book. It's kind of, we're giving everyone the kind of high concept and the bit that we think will get them interested. And there's an element of the story that Shane, the editor and publisher, was quite keen to include on the Kickstarter. And I thought, oh, that might be a real hook for people. But then I literally went, that happens on like page 24, kind of the end of what would be the first issue or the first arc. I just looked at it and went, although that could help us, I don't want to spoil that bit for everybody. I'd rather people kind of, you know, get the idea that Cale Beckett is this guy that's going to go back to Pluto, but the other kind of layers of the story, you know, you don't get those until you read the book, because I know what it's like when somebody spoils part of something and then you try to still enjoy it. It's annoying, so I don't want to annoy people with that.
Are people going to find, I mean, because what's inspired you behind this beyond something like Flash Gordon? I mean, is anything like Men in Black inspired this at all?
Tonally, I would say things that aren't necessarily sci-fi at all. So things like Unforgiven, because that's obviously about a hero that has given up violence and then is brought back into it. And the Warren Ellis series, Red, not just the inspiration for the movies, but very different than the movies. And that's, again, kind of about a guy that's kind of given up violence and is brought back in. So I really like those kind of stories. So many stories, particularly comics, are about someone who's starting out. And maybe, you know, say with sort of superhero books tends to be someone quite young who's getting powers and sort of discovering how to use them. But I'm quite interested in telling a story where it's someone that's, you know, isn't in the flushes of youth, has lived a kind of tough life, but actually gets drawn back into the adventure. So those kind of things. But it's, from a slight, I think things like Capricorn One and kind of, all sorts of things are kind of, are in the melting pot, I guess, for where the inspiration came from.
I quite like the idea of someone being dragged back in, because that is an old idea, which you haven't really seen much of the last few years, especially.
No, I think as Hollywood's kind of gone reboot-tastic, and I think this, you know, that's one thing. I think also kind of people are trying to get a younger audience in comics, so I think a lot of the heroes tend to be relatively young. And it was one of the things we kind of thought, do we need to put in another character as like an entry point for people? I was quite keen to keep it as somebody that was older, and just think it's quite interesting. It's quite interesting because, you know, they always say, you know, start a story partway through, and I think actually starting it almost at the end of, not the end of someone's life as such, but quite a long way into their life, kind of just gives you a bit more scope, really, because there's more baggage to the character and there's more things that you don't know what they are that are maybe boiling, you know, bubbling away under the surface.
Yeah.
You saying about putting in a younger character to try and get a wider, it's just reminding me of what happened with Final Fantasy XII so much right now. And I'm cringing inwardly at this, because they essentially did shoehorn in two younger characters and made the male one of the pair like the main character when clearly he wasn't originally designed to be the main character. So not bending to those kinds of market sensibilities is quite cool, because for me that kind of ruined the game from the story
perspective. All hell, Captain Wesley Crusher.
That was another thing I wanted to ask. What kind of art style do you think is kind of inspiring the graphic at the moment mainly? Is there any particular style, or is it I can't say his name.
Giancarlo.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting having changed artists, because when it was a kind of a painterly style, there was a certain look to it, and a certain richness. But what I really like about Giancarlo's art, and Shane is saying, is it's really kinetic. There's always a feeling of movement, which obviously in a static page is quite an achievement. So I think that what I really like doing is starting a project before an artist is on board, but not taking it too far scripting wise until you know which the artist is that you're writing for, which I think in a creator own project you can do. I mean, the Interactives was the other graphic novel I've had out before, and we had quite a lot of artists try out for that. And once I knew that another person has got a hard name to say, Luciano Vecchio, who's an Argentinian artist, once I knew that he was doing it, once I'd seen his character designs and he'd done the first few pages, the story kind of, the characters kind of changed ever so slightly, because they're not just the picture in your head. They are, you know, you can see them, and I think that really helps the interpretation. So I think it's part of the collaborative. That's what I like about writing for comics. It's part of the collaborative process, is that somebody else is telling the story alongside you, and because of that, I think it makes the storytelling that much stronger.
Obviously, you said earlier about alternative funding models. Models. Does that include potentially, like, obviously, if the Kickstarter wasn't funded, would you be taking it to something like Indiegogo, or would you go completely or almost completely non-crowdfunded route as alternative?
We haven't really decided yet. I know a few people that Indiegogo is an option. Also, kind of maybe scaling things back a bit. And maybe looking at, you know, single issues or something through Kickstarter. But I think we need to make that decision once the campaign's finished, really. And just take it from there. Again, it's also, you know, the availability of the artist, because if it isn't successful and, you know, a few months pass and then we do manage to get funding together, you know, we might have missed our window of opportunity with Giancarlo as well, because, you know, having mentioned the sort of things that he's worked on before, he may not be available as long as we'd like. So,
obviously, a huge part of this is set. The Forgotten Planet is set in the 70s. Out of interest, how have you worked around working in sort of like the social sensibilities of the time? What are we talking about in terms of sensibilities? Are we talking like what happened with Life on Mars and? What's his face? Or are we talking something that's a bit more respectful in this day and age?
I think it's pretty much respectful in this day and age. I think the good thing is that we're, you know, it's all the 70s stuff happens on Pluto, so we're on neutral territory to a certain extent, so kind of cultural boundaries are a little bit different. It's the 70s part are very much setting up kind of the history, because Kale's two best friends, this is only mild spoilers if people have seen the preview pages, they're his two members of his team that he was with on Pluto, the two of the people that are killed at the start of the book. And I can say that's already online, those pages. It's page one and page two of the book. So and that's kind of the lead in, really, is that, you know, not only are various people being killed, but his friends are being killed. But yeah, I think in terms of sensibilities, I mean, pretty much all of my stories, although on the like good sci-fi, hopefully, on the surface, they're high concept and action, adventure, there's usually a bit of social commentary underneath as well. And there is some in this, but again, that's kind of part of the wider themes of the book that I think, you know, people need to read the whole thing to get. But certainly my sensibilities wouldn't fit with the kind of things in the 70s that were necessarily acceptable. So there's elements of the book that are kind of about how we treat other people that are different from us and stuff. So
I've got a question. Have you got like a story arc in mind, or is it going to be a case of You're just gonna kind of continue going until you kind of run out of steam or
self-contained.
It's fully plotted out. It's not 100% written yet, but most of it is. I've held back on kind of the final act again because of working with Giancarlo to kind of try and shape that. But what I tend to do is I'll write the overall plot almost as a prose piece, just to give me an outline, and then I literally break it down in pages. So I'll literally, you know, write 1 to 100, and then kind of work out what the beats are. Before I write anything, it gives me a kind of skeleton to work through as I'm writing. I don't always necessarily stick to that, but at least I know where each scene is heading. And then sometimes what will happen is, you know, you might get 20 pages in and go, actually, I'm going to take this slight detour. And what I'll do then is go back to the plan, tweak it around a little bit. Or, you know, with the interactions, I can remember sort of moving a couple of scenes around after it was written. But I think you need to have a sense of what your whole plot is, particularly what your ending is. I know some of my early stuff, particularly my kind of shorter anthology stories, we got really good reviews, but most of them said, you know, this guy set up these amazing things and doesn't know how to finish them. And I think a lot of that was because I hadn't planned the endings. And it kind of, so what I've tried to do now is go, okay, honestly, this book, for me, and certainly some of the messages behind it, are very much tied to how it ends, which makes it much, you know, if you know where you're heading, it's much easier to kind of experiment as you go. So.
Yeah, I have to admit that I've noticed a tendency with kind of like TV series, for example, they really don't know how to end stuff properly because they're always up in the air about whether they're going to get cancelled or whether they're going to actually get another season and whatnot. And so I can kind of understand, you know, kind of the want to just basically say, no, this is where it's ending and this is how it's going to be done.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the good thing with something like that. With a graphic novel is, you know, you've got, we agreed a page count and that's the page count. So, you know, it has to end on page 100. So, you know, that's the way I've got to approach it, really.
I have interest if things are sort of like okay with funding and you guys are successful, because I'm really liking the sound of this. Are there any particular cons that people might want to look out for you guys making an appearance of as you sort of slowly promote things?
The majority of the UK, I say if it goes ahead, then the majority of the UK cons would be a given, really, and then we'd have to take it from there about anywhere further afield, really. Because I wouldn't want people to go, oh, we've crowdfunded you, and off you go to San Diego. Where did that money go? So I'd love to do American cons. I haven't been to one yet, but I've been to most of the UK cons. You know, things like Thought Bubble, I think, have taken kind of UK conventions on another step. I went to the first Cardiff Film and Comic Con recently, which is where I live, which makes it really straightforward for me as well. But and kind of the London cons are all great. So and there's another con in Cardiff as well, where I live, and Bristol and stuff. So I think the UK, when I was first going to comic conventions, kind of like in 2000, it was just Bristol, and then it was Bristol and Birmingham, and now I think there are more kind of comic conventions in the UK than there's probably one every weekend, pretty much. And it's a great, because it's a great mixture of kind of different, I mean, people can get to ones that maybe can't travel as far and stuff. So I'd imagine if the book comes out, we'll probably be here, there and everywhere, you know, spreading the word.
Okay, I want you to name the coolest thing about Forgotten Planet, and then we're going to time you, and you're going to have 1 minute to say why you think people should back the graphic novel. So first off, what's the coolest thing?
The coolest thing is the temperature on Pluto.
That is a respectful answer, that is. I like it. Okay, and I'm going to time you. You have to say in 1 minute why you think people should back Forgotten Planet, the graphic novel, on Kickstarter. Starting from now.
You should back the Forgotten Planet Kickstarter because I think it's a really interesting high concept. The mystery of kind of Pluto, it's a real event that's kind of sparked the story. It's full of action and adventure because this character's kind of revisiting his past. Amazing art from Giancarlo Caracuzzo. And, you know, we'd really like to get the book out there so people can read it and see for themselves some of the things that I've alluded to, but I couldn't say that you'll only be able to read if you read the whole mini-series. So we think it's got bags of potential. So if you back it, then it's a way to pre-order the book and make sure that it comes out so that you can get in your hands and find out exactly what the mystery is behind Pluto and everything that's happened.
Well, you did that in less than a minute. You've still got time, unless there's like a sentence that's leaking into your head in less than 10 seconds. But no?
I've gone blank now.
Okay. Okay, that was pretty in depth. I do believe that is all we've got time for this week. And it's goodbye from
Pete Rogers. You can find me on Twitter at Pete Rogers and my blog, which is peter-rogers.com.
And it's good night from me, Paul Wood. I'm Super Retroid on Twitter and Retroid on Eurogamer.net.
It's good night from me, Paul Blewett. I have a website, paul-blewett.com, and I'm on Twitter as Paul Blewett.
And it's good night from me, Emily King. You can find me on Twitter at ek6891. You can also find Nerd Assemble over at www.nerdassemble.co.uk. You can also find us on iTunes. You can find us on Twitter at Nerd Podcast. Plus, you can find us lurking around Facebook and Google Plus, Nerd Assemble Podcast. Don't forget to check out Hex Dimension at hexdimension.com. And we are still looking for contributors, and we might actually have some stuff coming from some new people soon as well. You should also check out Paul, confessing totally everything that's been going horribly wrong in our Pathfinder campaign. At least that's what it feels like. Everything is going horribly wrong with the Pathfinder campaign that we've recently been running.
Is that what you think that is? That video? It's a confession.
Yeah, it feels like it. Yeah. Anyway, it's a good night.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night.